This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week, we will conclude our January series of chatting with composers and carry that out to its furthest extension, as we'll speak with an artist we featured on last Friday's broadcast of music from the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, composer, cellist, Zoe Keating. That is her recorded at the IAS and what we broadcast last Friday, performing her own works. That is all she performs, music created spontaneously in front of her audience with her cello, her laptop, and a pedal which acts as a tool to control and loop, record, combine, layer the music she is playing at the moment. This is a work she titled Escape Artist. She has managed to escape the route of conventional musician and carve out a very unique space of creating and performing that is wholly her own. She was born in Canada, studied in New York, and was on the track to becoming a classical cellist. Stage fright derailed that ambition, and she went to the Bay Area working in the tech industry and learning much that would shape her career. When the boom became a bust in the tech world, she turned back to music and began playing with non-classical music bands and improvising a lot, a form of playing that in front of audiences dispelled her stage fright. Then she began creating her own works using technology, and those works have found their way into car commercials that were aired during a Super Bowl, mainstream major network television series, music used by NPR for their evergreen All Things Considered, and also used by numerous dance troupes, and so much more. Her life was blessed with the birth of a son and then cut to tragedy with the very sudden and unexpected death of her husband. For a one-person creative force and industry, it was devastating. Now finding her way back, she picked up from the West Coast, moved to the East Coast, and now lives in Vermont. She champions causes dear to her heart and her career, health insurance and artists' rights to their own property. She's testified before Congress and even recorded TED Talks about these subjects, upon which she has, through experience and necessity, become well acquainted. She and I spoke by phone last week. I'm very happy today to be speaking with, and I guess here's the problem right off the bat. I'm not the first one, but composer, cellist, cellist, composer, none of the two, artist, musician. How, if you have to be ID'd, how do you like you to be ID'd?
Gosh, I find that so hard. It's so hard to be categorized.
Yeah.
For a long time, I think I was too shy about the word composer because I wasn't writing any of the music down.
Yeah.
But... So I just called myself a cellist. And then I was like, well, I'm not really just cellist because I'm only playing music that I make.
Right.
So I call myself kind of a composer performer.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good because that whole trend, which is very cool, is coming back big time over the last 15 years ago. Yeah. So last Friday, our listeners heard you as a featured artist in our Music from the Institute for Advanced Study series presented by their current artist in residence, David Lang. You were also, this being the final Thursday of January, you were also the final cadenza where this month every program I have spoken with composers, and one of them was still a practicing pianist, though he's known as a composer. One was a theorist composer. But as our little exchange, our listeners heard, you kind of take that out to a further ring, further out, meaning composer, performer, like you said, composer, creator, proprietary composer, spontaneous creator, performer. You perform your own compositions. They can only really be played by you. They happen in the moment of creation, basically. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty unique thing. There ain't many out there like you. And as we'll hear in your music and everything, as people hear or listen to your music and it reaches and touches them, that's happened all over the globe. So a couple questions off of that before we get into your career. So music that is going to change, at least slightly change from performance to performance, because you are creating much of it on the spot. I don't know if any of this music in any way is notated. As I said, no other performer could perform it or interpret it. You are the sole interpreter of your music. Is this what you knew you wanted? Is this exactly what fulfills you? I mean, do you see things developing, becoming different as you go on? I mean, where you're at right now in your career, what you're doing, is this it?
There's a lot of layers in there.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. But I thought I'd start way up and then come down.
Well, first of all, I never anticipated any of this. I feel like my entire career has been, it's just unfolded organically.
Okay.
I was going sort of towards an aesthetic, something that I wanted to listen to myself. And initially, when I was making, sort of figuring out what my voice was, that's sort of something musicians do when they're younger, try to find your voice.
Right.
And I was playing cello with a lot of different musical groups and just kind of exploring style. And it was a really fertile time in San Francisco as well. This was kind of the late 90s and the early 2000s. And I wasn't playing classical music. I was just playing music that was not written down. And all the groups I played with, they didn't write music down either. It was improvised. Hmm. You know, you'd improvise, you'd work things out. They kind of came out of the genres were sort of instrumental post-rock, ambient, kind of slightly jazz. There were a lot of sort of free-form groups at the time. There were a lot of different musical styles. And so I was just sort of playing and finding my aesthetic. And there was music that I just wanted to make. And I started recording the cello onto, you know, the computer that I had. And I just loved the sound of the cello. It was really satisfying to me. So I initially tried to get some other cellists to sort of play these things that I was coming up with.
Okay.
And I found it actually surprisingly difficult because I'd already kind of evolved a style that was difficult to notate. And also, you know, I agonized over like how to notate these specific phrases. And then the two cellists I'd gotten to work with me, they were frustrated because it wasn't all written down. And I said, okay, just play this for a bit and then we'll shift it when we all feel it's right. Or we'll vary it a little bit. And I really wanted them to kind of like groove with me, you know. And I realized that classically trained musicians were kind of uncomfortable with that, and that I was not uncomfortable. In fact, I was more comfortable when things were not written down than I was playing classical music. So it became kind of perhaps inevitable that I would try to execute it myself. And that's sort of how this initially started, like figuring out, well, how could I layer up multiple cellos and allow myself to be fluid and to improvise with it? So that's how it started.
I think what's one of the things that's striking when someone sees you perform, I know I read that litany of things there, but one is that you would think, doesn't she want to play with other musicians, and doesn't she want to play other music by other composers, but you seem completely comfortable in everything you're doing. I mean, really kind of centered, and you get that feeling watching you perform.
I love making this music. You know,
yeah.
I like doing it. I still occasionally play with other people, but ultimately I have something that I'm trying to make, and hopefully in my lifetime I'll get there.
Right. Well, we're going to even go into how you do this with our audience. But if our audience is listening saying, this is very different, I think we should back the bus up and just say, you know, kind of how you got here. Born in Canada, you playing cello by the age of 8, studied New York State, wanted to be a classical cellist, like you said. And I guess sort of stage fright was the roadblock to that. You went to San Francisco and got into the tech industry, Java programming, interface design. And then the one title I did not give you at the top of the program, which was information architect, which I still have no idea what that is.
Yeah, that was on my business card for a long time. I actually feel like I'm still doing information architecture, but I just happen to be doing it with music.
Oh, that's cool.
So it feels really related. My tech career feels really related to my musical career in some ways, but maybe that's just my brain.
So you were doing all this on the tech side in San Francisco, and then what I wanted to do, take us back to that point where there were pivotal points and decisions you made so that you would once again not only embrace music, but want to be a music. You know what I'm saying? You had to sort of shift things as you were going. So take us back there.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to be a professional musician. When I was in high school, I actually wanted to be a conductor.
Yeah.
I used to turn all the lights off in my room and pull the shades and get Beethoven going, and I would conduct my imaginary orchestra. So it seemed to me that music was my path, but I felt really boxed in by how you have to get to a classical career. You know, you have to audition, and you have to audition, and audition, and audition. And I did have, you know, I was struck by really paralyzing stage fright.
Yeah.
You know, which you mentioned. And that made it so that, like, yeah, this was really before the days of blind auditions. And if you put me behind a screen, I remember there was one blind audition that I had for the New York Youth Symphony when I was in college. And that was great because I did fine because they couldn't see me. And I got in. But if you put me in a room facing people, I would just collapse. So I was like, you know what? This is just not for me. And plus, I was always really interested in other stuff. Like, but, you know, I had my tech career and I was, you know, basically trying to pay back my student loans. And here was a lucrative way to do it.
Right.
And it was really interesting. My work was fascinating. And everybody at that time in San Francisco who had these jobs, everyone was multidimensional. Like in the company I worked for, initially there were 7 employees and so many of them were musicians. We played music together. And then I had music in the evenings. All that came to a crashing halt with the end of the dot-com boom.
Okay.
And the company that I worked for evaporated. And so they managed to orchestrate something called a fire sale, which is where everybody knows it's going down the tubes, but they tried to sell some element of the technology to another company. They did that, and I got payout, which nowadays doesn't seem that much to me, but it was enough for me at the time to take a break from working and to just focus on music. And I'd never had that luxury in my life before. I'd always had to work. You know, I had a job in a nursing home when I was 15, and I had tons of jobs through college, and I worked, the day after I left school. I was always just trying to survive. And so getting that money was the first time that I could actually just think about my art and what I wanted to do. So I gave myself a year off. I said, if I haven't got this figured out in a year, you know, I'll go back to the world of technology. And so I played with other musicians. I worked on my own stuff. I started having little concerts in the warehouse that I lived in. And it takes a long time to get a music career off the ground. But that was really how it started. And I did have to go back to tech just to make ends meet for another 2 years. But I was already had some momentum by then. And then I left for good. So.
Some of those musicians you were playing with then, if you got to put them in categories, they were playing pop rock bands. They were playing more of that type of music. What benefited you from playing with them, or what did you carry out from playing with them? And you already mentioned that a lot of them don't read music or notate their music, but, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, they wanted to add cello as a texture to their material, but they didn't necessarily know how to tell me what to do. And so I found that I actually had a skill, which was that I could hear a song once and I would know exactly how it goes. And I was really good at, I think, finding the right note to play that needed to be played. And it was also, it was a way for me to make money. Like I had a, you know, a kind of a thriving studio career. If I would go into a studio and I could play the cello for 2 hours with a band and I could do all the stuff for their music. So I just really enjoyed it. And also it was really satisfying. I don't think anybody ever gave me the positive feedback in the world of classical that I got just from a day of playing with a band.
Yeah.
You know, that's not to say their standards are low, but just that they're going for something different. They're not going for this sort of, you know, crystal perfection. They're going for a feel, a vibe. And that was something that I could do. Like I had a feeling for the music. So it was just really rewarding. And I found that there was something I could do there. And then also I find it like a fun challenge. Like this one group I played with, there were 5 of us and it was structured improvisation. And it was really challenging to go up there in front of an audience and try to figure out what you're going to do next, you know, and you sort of go into this sort of zone. And that feeling of being like taken out of time, I hear jazz musicians talk about this too, where you're in the flow.
Right.
That was really satisfying and I just loved it. So in a way, that kind of aspect of like going with the moment is really key to my music, I think, when I'm on stage.
You mentioned like the stage fright, and I guess this realm of improvisation that you were working with, however it was structured and whatever type of music you're playing, that was different for you, right? Because when you were improvising, it wasn't the same as playing Bach in front of an audience, you know?
I didn't have any stage fright at all. It doesn't bother me. I still get nervous. There's sometimes when, you know, I've had a few gigs where I have to play on TV and stuff, and, you know, I have 3 minutes to nail the song perfectly, and that makes me nervous because I feel like I have to do it right. But in my own performances, there was somebody who said, a jazz musician, and I'm forgetting who it was now, but, you know, it's not a mistake if you do it twice.
Right.
So that's
right,
what I try
right.
to do. I try to just play it twice. I'm like, hey, this is my own music. If I make a mistake, it's not a mistake, right? Sometimes I just tell the audience what happened. I say, hey, you know, I really screwed that up. Let's see if we can get out of this. And just that kind of honesty. Like sometimes I feel uncomfortable when I go to a classical performance and I find it so weird that the performers barely even acknowledge the audience. And for me, the other part of getting past my stage fright was to realize that we're all in this together and that everyone's on my side and they want to see me succeed. And so I feel like I'm not nervous because, you know, I have a relationship with the audience. And so part of my concerts are bringing the audience in and telling them what's happening, having like a relationship with them so that it's not just me who's going to hopefully have this flow experience. I want them to as well.
Well, yeah, and there's the logistic thing of there's no program handed out to the audience. They don't know the next piece of music you're going to play because it's yours, and they may not. And so you have to immediately have this bond with the audience because they're relying on you and you're relying on them. So it's very cool. From my guest Zoe Keating's last recording, available from her website, it is called Snowmelt. This is the track titled Possible. So we've kind of laid out a lot of these ingredients, you know, the tech career and doing this music, which lets you really sort of hone in on your improvisational chops, but also creating music in a space. So this kind of leads us to what you do. And I thought if you could, for those that didn't get to see you at the IIS, but or don't know your artistry, haven't seen you in various videos around. So you come out on stage with a cello, you have a laptop, and you have this pedal, which is like this all-divine, omnipotent pedal, which has to do a lot for you. But then what happens? I mean, I know you have some music that you have in your head, but kind of explain what then happens. How does a piece of music from Zoe Keating become created at that point for the audience?
Well, the computer and the pedal are, you know, tools to kind of execute what I want to do.
Right.
It feels very simple to me. I have a microphone on the cello that goes into the computer, and I can control all the aspects of the programs that I'm using. And the programs do things like, as I'm playing a phrase, I can tell the computer to sample little parts of the phrase and store it. Or I can tell the computer to start recording, make the recording a certain length, and just play it back until I tell it to stop. I can add tracks. I can do all the things that you might do in a studio situation, but on the fly.
Right.
So it's a cross between like studio multi-tracking and being a DJ of myself. And so the things that I'm doing with my feet are, well, I could back up a bit in that initially when I started doing this, it was very linear in that I didn't have a lot of control over what I had already played or already recorded. And every single action that I wanted to do in the software had to be done with a foot. So you can imagine that as the pieces got more complex, there was a lot of tap dancing. And my rehearsing would be like 5% practicing the music and 95% just practicing the right foot pedal, foot button presses at what time and where. And you know, I had like 100 buttons. And so then I developed this technique for like batch commands. Any good programmer would know, would recognize that having one piece of code do one action, you know, it's not very efficient. You want to group things up and make them object oriented so that little modules of things can do multiple things instead of some. And you know, music is made up of kind of the same parts in some ways, the same sort of actions, the same sort of phrases. For example, what would be a module is a command that says, okay, I want you to start recording on track one for 2 bars and then stop recording. The next action is going to be start recording on track two for 4 bars, then stop recording. Then you're going to record on track three, and after 8 bars, you're going to fade down track one.
Okay.
That's a batch. And so when I press a button, that batch of timed commands gets sent to the computer. So then all I have to do is play the cello. And then that batch might trigger another batch, or I can use my foot to send it in a different direction to a different batch of operations. Or I can always take over with my feet to do everything with a one-to-one relationship. So that's what I'm doing. And it gives me flexibility so that I can either play the same piece exactly the same way every time, or I can take it in different places if I want to.
Yeah, you make it sound so simple, but I mean, this is really right brain, left brain type of stuff going, because you're doing the normal action of playing a cello, which is, you know, just what comes naturally, but fingering, intonation, tuning, getting everything that makes the cello sound. Now you've added this whole other layer because you say all these, telling the computer to do this, I'm stepping on the pedal, but you're doing that while you're playing. That's the interesting thing. This whole thing of creation as it happens, and of course, your works have a lot of layering as you layer all these things you're doing and or parts of them even, which is also a fascinating thing.
I don't find that particularly difficult, but I realize that that might make me unique. But it feels like I'm just playing the computer like an instrument, just like I'm playing the cello.
Yeah. Like I said, it is seamless when you watch what you're doing. Therefore, just to go on the compositional side of it, how does it start? What's the genesis? Is it just a short phrase? Is it some kind of progression of, even if a single line, you know, cello single line, though you can do double stops, some kind of harmonic thing in your head where you're going, maybe it's not the same for every work, but how's a piece start?
Well, like if I'm going to like totally improvise and start from scratch, I'll just make a sound on the cello. And then, you know, you make the sound in a particular rhythm and then I just start layering and I'm improvising with myself. Sometimes it starts out as a particular phrase that I have stuck in my head. and I'll record the phrase, and then I'll just work with it. Sometimes it's a feeling, like I want to create an ominous sense of doom.
Right.
And so I just think about the ominous sense of doom, and then music happens. In some ways, you know, I've gotten into film scoring, and I found that's something else that I can do that I enjoy. It's just like I just think of a setting or a mood, and I can just think about that, and then music starts layering up in that space. So sometimes I want to create a sense of spaciousness or, you know, a journey, or, and I just think about it that way. And then once I have something, if I'm working on a piece in the studio, I'll have some little riff or something, and I'm playing it, and I just record it, and I start improvising and see what happens. And it's kind of through hearing something over and over and over again that I start hearing other things it could be. So I might build from there into something else and then take away what I started with, you know?
Right.
A friend of mine's an oil painter, and I've watched him paint, and he sort of adds layers and layers and layers of oil paints, and the paintings shift until sometimes what he painted underneath is no longer visible. It's a new painting. And
right.
Sometimes I feel like my music is like that. I start with something, and then the original thing is gone, and you're left with kind of an echo of it or something.
It's interesting as you were saying all that. I was thinking that in a way, what you do harkens back. I mean, I went to school in the late 70s and 80s in higher education. So I played in my fair share of conceptual music concerts. But and there is a conceptual weight of what you just said, only back then they didn't have the technology to make the concept really work many times. And you do, which is interesting. It's kind of the same aesthetic.
That's funny you should say that, because, I mean, all of my instructors at Sarah Lawrence were probably from that era.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had, you know, the fur music. I played a piece where you had to be an angel one minute and a demon the next minute on your instrument. And, you know, Pauline Oliveris, all this kind of stuff. But it's this, there's the concept, there's a germ of the concept that's the same.
I think also in some ways I try to be in my music deliberately like anti-conceptual. Like, I mean, like I say that I'm trying to create a sense of doom, but I'm even reluctant to give titles to things. Like, I feel like there's so many times in the world where you're forced to focus on the meaning, or like people believe they can't understand something unless they know what the meaning of it is or what the artist is trying to say and all that. I'm just trying to create a sound and an experience. And, I don't know, it's sort of a mixture of aesthetics and experience, you know? So it's like a expressionism or something.
Well, I was going to go there next with the titling of works. I mean, you did one piece at the IES, which didn't even have a title on the concert last Friday night, but there is a point where whether it's different every time you play it in some fashion, whether it's a little bit longer, but there is a point where a piece seems to be somewhat finished in quotations in your head. And then, of course, that piece would get a title. And, you know, it sounds like some of the titles are very caught up in your personal life. Your recent EP you put out last year, Snowmelt, right? Very metaphysical title. Just to talk about your career, what you had to go through. You and your husband had a child, and then shortly afterwards and quickly afterwards, he was diagnosed with cancer and passed away.
Yeah.
You said how time just stopped for you. Your narrative stopped as the music just couldn't happen. And it's not like you could have a blank stare, go into an orchestra, sit down and plow through Brahms and Tchaikovsky and get a check. That wasn't what you were doing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you were a single parent, grieving wife, and maybe just talk about how music, amazingly, and the miracle of it, especially in this, in your case, creating your own music, sort of eventually brought you out, or at least let you go on. I mean, but it was a while before that happened. But
yeah,
if you can talk about,
you know, well, it's funny. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's normal for artists. But it's hard to get a sense of what your, you know, musical expression slash career is as it's happening.
And yeah.
Maybe now I've been doing it long enough that I can see what it is for me. And I can see that my music is sort of an expression of me and my life and what's happening. So it's like another way for me to communicate. So it kind of makes sense that, like, since everything kind of came to like a grinding halt for that time, that, yeah, my music did as well. And so they kind of went hand in hand. It's like a chicken or an egg. Like, as I started being able to kind of think about having a future, then I started being able to write music again. Now, was it because I was writing music again that I could have a future? Or, you know, I can't even say. It's such an expression of me. But, you know, a lot of the work that I was working on, I really started working on another album, like, between 2012 and 2014.
Right.
It was 2 years after my son was born, and I was getting back to writing music. And all of that stuff, I just had to throw it out.
Right.
Like, it was just, it didn't mean anything to me. And maybe someday I'll go back to that, but I just kind of had to start from scratch. So it was really daunting. But just the experience of finishing a single piece of music, and, like, new piece of music, like, writing it and finishing, it was so, you know, necessary for me. to say, like, hey, things aren't over. You can actually still write music. Because I had some worries. I was like, gosh, you know, what if this is the end? And I just have to go back to tech now. So releasing that EP was kind of like really important for me that I could still do this. So the other thing was that performing, like I did perform during that time, and performing was incredible because I have the best audience. Like they're so great. And I feel like I'm so lucky that I can go, you know, all over the place and find a really appreciative, warm audience who just makes me feel like they're so happy to see me and they want me to be there and they're enjoying the music. And I feel like I need them more than I ever realized.
Yeah.
And performing is actually way better for me now than it was before, just because I think it sounds totally corny, but I feel their love.
Yeah. Going back to an earlier album titled One Cello Times 16 Natoma, Natoma being the name of a place in California dear to her and her late husband, here are the first few minutes of my guest Zoe Keating performing her work titled simply Fern. Finding an audience. I mean, your music has made its way into mass media consumption. You had music in a car commercial that aired in the Super Bowl. Your music has turned up in TV series like the Sherlock series Elementary, The Return, Manhattan. It's been on NPR, All Things Considered. You even had some music in a Breaking Bad episode. Is that true? Something like that?
Well, yeah, they actually, it's a little different in that the composer of that show contacted me to ask if I would make a cello version of the theme. So I made a cello version of the theme that got sort of used throughout episode 6 in season 1. So even before it kind of bust out of the show. Yeah. So if you want to hear it, it's in there.
So, I mean, when your music goes that out there, what's it like to find that out? And because of the nature of who you are, I mean, our listeners have heard what kind of performer and composer and creator you are. You're playing your own music in a time. I mean, is it good or bad to have your music? I mean, the money that comes in is probably very nice, but if there is money. But I mean, what's it like to have your music out there where you didn't think it would go, if you get my drift, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm still shocked by it. I remember when it first appeared on NPR in like 2006 or 2007. And like, I believed in it,
right.
But I didn't really think that it was a viable kind of music to make a career out of. I mean, it's instrumental and not singing. It's not classical. It's not pop.
I
didn't even know a genre. All the record labels I sent it to rejected it. And I've still yet to have a record label say yes. But I feel like maybe I'm doing something right, you know, because it takes me a really long time to get a piece to a state that I'm happy with, so I release it to the world. And I feel like I make it so that I can listen to it 1,000 times and not be annoyed.
Right.
So I feel like maybe that it means something. And I find it amazing that the songs mean so much to other people. Like, people write me letters and tell me about, you know, this was a song that they played when their father was dying, or this is a song they played when their daughter was born, or this is a song they walked down the aisle to, like really intense personal thing. I mean, I think that's what every artist dreams of, right? It's not about the money. It's about, like, you want your work to touch people. And again, going back to, if my music is an extension of me and myself, then I feel like I've done something that's meaningful to people. That really is satisfying.
But
there
also
are times when it's annoying, but yes, but mostly it's
Well, it's annoying too, because the music you present that's yours can change from performance to performance. And some of these, when it gets in the mass media, they want it to sound the same every time, you know, that catch type of thing. It's weird.
Yeah, that does happen. People say, like, oh, you played Sun Will Set, but it's not like on the album. And I wanted to hear the album version.
Right.
And then also, again, so much of this, it's all organic and sometimes feels accidental. So somehow in there, my works became widely used in the world of dance. And I had a ballet critic say to me recently that he said, you know, Zoe, your music is as widespread in the world of dance as Philip Glass's was in, you know, the turn of the millennium.
Wow.
And YouTube kind of bears that out. Like, I have something called a content management account where they have this, you know, robot that goes and watches videos, scans videos for music, and then matches the content to, you know. And so it sucks them up every day. And it's found 20,000 videos to date that have my music in them, and they're mostly dance performances. That's like amazing. And at the same time, you're like, gosh, you know, if only I had like $10 from all of them, I maybe could have some money, because of course nobody gets permission or even pays for it. So.
Yeah, well, that's the next issue here, because those 20,000 YouTube videos, which have your music in, and this might shock our audience, you didn't put any of them up. You haven't, you know? You've been very... You know, one of the issues that really concern you is artists' rights, controlling of what you have. I mean, people have heard how you create your own music. You want to get it out there. You want it disseminated. You want people to hear it. But you want, if there's compensation, to happen. A lot of the big corporations used to cry about either file sharing or piracy issues and all these demons. Right. But individual artists just want a clear path to get their music out. If there's compensation, transparency. And this has been a really... not a sore spot with you, but this really, you were invested in this issue. So maybe just talk a little about it.
I feel like I've just tried to state what it's like for an independent artist, what my point of view is, what my world is like. I noticed early on that the way that I make a living and wasn't really well represented in the press, there was kind of this, when I initially started talking about this, there was sort of this, you know, big dichotomy about like the music industry versus piracy. And that wasn't my world. I never saw file sharing / piracy is a problem. And I don't think it was something that ever impacted me. So, you know, I've just tried to say like, hey, actually, that's not my issue. This is my issue, and talk about things. And so something like YouTube, like, yeah, there's 20,000 videos. It's wonderful that the people put them in their videos and that they used it. But number one, it would be nice if there was some way to get some of that money to me, because YouTube is happy to make money off those videos in the form of advertising.
Right.
So I just try to speak up and say, like, you know, hey, here I am, and here's a lot of artists like me. And it's never going to be in the interest of a large corporation to put a story like mine forward. So I feel like it's my job to kind of speak up. And it comes up all the time recently with, you know, streaming is taken over. And, you know, those are companies that are, they're designed to sell subscriptions, not to sell music. And so I just try to point out, like, hey, you know, this is a really great way for people to listen to music. I use streaming music as well to listen. However, if there's something that I really love, if there's something that you really love and really listen to, go out there and support it directly.
Right.
It goes for your public radio station, and it goes for the artists that you care about. Because that's how we survive. And there's only going to be a small fraction of the listening audience that is going to care enough to do that. But that's all I need. I don't need everybody to go to ZoeKeating.com and download a song, or, you know, put money in the virtual tip jar.
Right.
I only need maybe 10% of people to do that. So,
well, I mean... classical music stations still exist, barely, but still exist, on the fact that one out of every 10 people listening supports the station.
Yeah. So there's like all the, you know, the music companies that are out there, they have huge, huge marketing budgets.
Right.
And I don't have a marketing budget. So like Spotify, as an example, can have a huge music budget, say like, hey, in their advertising campaign, hey, we're saving the music industry. And I can say, like, hey, actually, if you want the musicians you love to keep making a living, this is what you should do. So I just try to encourage other artists to speak up. It's sort of my role to tell my story so people know that I am an individual. And if they care enough, they will follow me. And, you know, and some won't care at all, but that's just how the world is.
Yeah, and you're very transparent about it. If you go to your website, you post your earnings from all these various carriers and platforms that people can hear your music that do compensate you. It's kind of sobering reading some of that. And I don't think there's any kind of a good solution still there, even though we've been dealing with this now for, what, over 2 decades. But, you know, still, yeah, it's still an issue. And, you know, you can have a group like a Radiohead that goes out and puts out a record and says, we're just going to put it out there and donate what you want. And then they can say, oh, we made so much money on it. But for an artist like you, that's not going to work all the time. And you're just saying those that enjoy your music, support your music, I guess. That's right.
And you know, the other thing is you have to have lots of different income streams.
But sure.
I'm in a slightly odd position from some in that most artists, when they get to my level, they just tour a lot. But I can't do that because I'm a single mom.
Right.
So the revenue option of just tour isn't necessarily available to me. So I'm lucky that I do have a fair amount of commercial licensing that can make up for it. But that kind of falls out of the sky for me. I don't have anybody out there pursuing ads and commercials. They kind of just fall into my lap.
Yeah. Well, it's nice the ones that have those.
Yeah.
And more to come.
Yeah.
Turning once again to my guest's recording One Cello Times 16 Natoma, here is Zoe Keating performing her We Insist. know you said you live in the moment with how you create music and what you do with your music and performing your music. Do you see yourself doing larger works, the works that may involve, I know you tried with other musicians, but I mean, as you develop things, do you see bringing in collaborations, maybe not with other musicians, but I mean, how do you see things developing as you go?
Well, I mean, I'm a megalomaniac and my ambitions are huge. I'm always pushing the envelope and I get bored easily. So right now I have a few things that I'm hatching and more incubating.
Right.
They're not hatching yet. Some of my works have actually been transcribed for string ensemble.
Okay.
So I had a performance with them in San Francisco a few years ago just to see what that would be like. And there were some good things about it and some bad things about it. And so what I'm trying to do is take, you know, all of my recordings so far and actually transcribe them for ensembles, because I would really like, you know, like youth orchestras to be able to play them, because those are like the musicians who I care about the most sometimes, like teenagers who need to make the music theirs in order to stick with it, you know, to get through high school and stuff. And so I really have a soft spot for teenagers playing string instruments and just youth orchestras in general. So I'm doing that. And then in terms of writing music, I started out doing longer form pieces and then I switched to short ones because of the presentation. Like, I was playing in nightclubs and I was opening up for pop artists.
Right.
And the audiences had really short attention spans. So it was like a real challenge, like, oh, how could I say what I want to say in 5 minutes or less? And in a way, that's what I was doing. And now I'm going back to like, hey, I'd like to say something in some longer form work. So I'm writing some sort of long form works. And then the other thing is, the last TV show I worked on was called Manhattan, and I composed score for it. And a lot of it was brass, and it was the first time I'd ever written for something that wasn't just cello. And I really liked the way it sounded. And this is part of me getting bored, is that sometimes I'm just tired of the sounds cello can make, and I want something else. So I was thinking that I'd like to, well, I've started already like just writing some pieces for other instruments and seeing if I get other people to play them and pushing myself, really. I think that's what any artist does. There's like an aesthetic, there's a musical aesthetic and a musical thing that I'm trying to make, and I haven't gotten there yet, and I hope eventually to get there, you know? So it's all like one long trajectory towards something that I'm trying to make.
I don't know this, but you would maybe. Is the technology and the software capable of, you said how some of your pieces are being transcribed for string orchestra, for large, you know, and then doing this with youth orchestras. Is it possible to do exactly what you do on stage with a single cello with a larger ensemble playing your music, meaning recording it and looping it back? So you could create, but using a large orchestra instead of just a single performer? Is that possible?
There are some technical limitations in the world of sound bleed.
Okay.
I try to hide all this from the audience when I'm playing, but it's one of the things that is tricky, is that there's music being coming out of the speakers, right, that I've just played. And if I start re-recording that, re-recording what's coming out of the speakers into the computer, it's a royal mess. So the problem that you would have with an orchestra is there's no sound isolation unless they're playing electronic instruments.
Okay.
So you could do it if they were playing electronic instruments, or, I don't know, somehow in little like ISO booths or something, but the bleed on the microphones would be the tricky part.
Okay.
That's not to say it's not possible, but I would like to be able to experiment with these things. And it's also possible that all the things that I'm using software-wise, you can get out of the box now. I still use a funny kind of hodgepodge of little software bits together on stage, but, you know, there's much like those 70s composers, you know, those very early computer pieces I saw,
yeah.
I guess the early 80s, that I've seen performed later, you know, it could be like orchestra and computer, and it's feasible that you could have a program that would run, you know, while the cellist plays. There is right now a dance ensemble on tour playing my music. It initially started as something for me to do live. I wrote the score for the performance and performed it with them a whole bunch of times. And then when my husband got sick, I couldn't go with them. So I played all the parts and gave them a mix of all those parts. And then they have one cellist who plays the lead part as a solo. So they play back the recording and then she plays the lead part. So it's not the same, but it is sort of a live performance of something that works on stage because she's on stage with the dancers.
Well, you know, keep it all going. Like I said, I'm not sure which direction it's going to go, but it's all, you know, fascinating stuff. And like I said, there aren't many artists like you. In fact, I don't know of another one, but I'm just leaving the door open. Huh. There might be some.
Gosh. That's cool, but that's also kind of disappointing because I'm like, where are the others?
Well, I'm sure there's others doing something similar, but more in a tech vein. I think the fact that you bring in this, you know, acoustic instrument of the cello and make it that make it come from that makes it really just fascinating.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for the time. And I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking all my guests the same two questions. And the first question is a hypothetical, which simply says, if you could chat like we've been chatting, but chat with someone from the past, someone who never had a chance to talk to but could, I'm wondering what name pops into your head. Sometimes if you think about it, you get swamped. But I'm just wondering if there's somebody, if you could talk with someone from the past, who would it be?
Gosh. Well, I would love to meet Beethoven.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I'd like to ask him some questions about those symphonies and how he writes them. I don't know. I would like to go back into the past to hear some of those works being performed for the first time and to talk with him about how it went or what he was disappointed in or what he wanted to change or...
Yeah.
Was he as dissatisfied with his performances as I am with mine? You know.
Well, there was one fact. After a certain point, he didn't hear the performances. He just heard what
That's
was
true.
In his head,
That's
you know.
True.
But yeah, you're right. It's interesting to think of what a composer, I think of like Bach with modern technology, what a mind like that would have wrapped around being able to use technology that is almost endless as far as what could be. And I don't know, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Anything. Final question is non-musical, meaning everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music, and you are extremely busy since you are your music. When you have to do something that's non-musical, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but if you need to get away from what you're doing for a while and just sort of, what do? A little respite from music when you need to?
I walk.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I like to walk. And I like to walk, you know, through the woods. I like to go walk up a hill or walk across town. And then the other thing is bake a lot.
Okay, cool.
So I've taken up baking bread, so I'm trying to make the perfect sourdough loaf.
Okay, both of those things sound very Vermont-y to coin a word from White Christmas. But yeah, I mean, are you in an area where you can get out into nature and do all that?
Yeah, I live in Burlington, Vermont on Lake Champlain, and it's a great town because the town is really walkable, and then there's lots of parks and stuff nearby. It's a little challenging when it's 0 degrees Fahrenheit, I have to say. But, you know, I'm still working on that. I'm still kind of new here. But then I can bake, you know. So in fact, I have a loaf of bread happening downstairs right now.
Oh, and there's no smell component on the radio, unfortunately. So, Zoe Keating, thanks for taking some time.
Hey, thanks for talking to me. It was a really great interview. Thank you for talking.
Cellist composer Zoe Keating. You can find out more about her at her website, Zoe, Z-O-E, Keating, K-E-A-T-I-N-G, zoekeating.com. You can also download her music there as well, though you can find it many places through many carriers and platforms. But as she said, if her music touches you and means something to you and will be a part of your listening experience, please support it. I'll leave you with the closing minutes of another track from her latest recording, one that means so much to her moving forward, called Snowmelt. This is a work she also performed at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which we broadcast last week, and I'll put that concert up on the website next to this webcast. It is titled Forte, music composed by and performed by my guest today, Zoe Keating. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org.